This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Arsenal make it through to the quarterfinals of the Champions League for the first time in 14 years. It took David Raya to save twice in the penalty shootout after the Gunners matched Porto's 1-0 score from the first leg. A rare piece of brilliance from Martin Ødegaard and a rare defensive lapse from an otherwise brilliantly organised Porto. Pepe is 41. He was brilliant. Barca also make it through. 3-1 over Napoli makes it sound straightforward. But that wasn't the case after racing into a 2-0 lead. The Italians got one back, could have had a penalty, missed a huge chance at 2-1, but Barca also looked good, with teenagers Lamine Yamal and Pau Cabarsi seriously impressive. Then there's the race for 10th place in the Premier League as Chelsea beat Newcastle on Monday night. Crystal Palace and West Ham are accused of acting like King Canute over the EFL payments. I don't remember him disregarding the pyramid. Lots of you have been in touch about how good Lincoln City are for some unknown reason. Some of you really have done fridge audits after Monday. We'll answer your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Nicky Bandini, welcome.
Morning.
Hello, Johnny Liu.
Hi.
And hello, Nick Ames.
Hello, Max Rushton.
So there we are. Arsenal through 4-2 on penalties. I mean, it felt so tense, Nick, and I am 10,000 miles away from the Emirates. You were there. How was it?
Yeah, that was a proper crackling knife edge Champions League atmosphere. It was almost everything you want in a knockout tie. Like the team that everyone favours plays their beautiful football against the snarling opposition that has something to hold on to. And I thought, like, I don't know, as Barney was saying the same to me during extra time, you felt like you'd been watching the game forever, watching the same things happening time and time again for about 120 minutes. But I also found it absolutely fascinating. I thought it was a really good tie. Arteta, at the end of it, who obviously is never shy to betray happiness at a victory, he absolutely bounded into the press conference. You could not wipe that smile off his face. He was absolutely full of beans. You could see that he was, you know, it clearly meant a lot to have cleared the hurdle that he cleared. But yeah, those pens, there was a lot of discussion going on in the press box before they were taken about whether Arsenal had the minerals to come through it, whether they would bottle it, etc., etc. And I've got to say, they really handled that pressure brilliantly. I thought the fans did their job, waving the scarves behind the goal at the Porto players and making a lot of racket. And Arsenal just kept their composure superbly. The penalties were pretty flawless. But Porto keeper, on the other hand, was a bit of a hologram, I thought, on those spot kicks. He just sort of stood there and didn't really do much. But you've got to say, it was quite an impressively seen out win. When you zoom out and look at the Arsenal performance, which I'm sure we will do, over the two legs, it wasn't particularly impressive. And I think you could probably make an argument that if Porto take their penalties better, or Arsenal take theirs worse. We're talking now about Sergio Conceição doing a job on Mikel Arteta, and Arteta's European inexperience being shown up and unable to win a European knockout tie, losing another one at home. You know, the narratives that have been stacking up beforehand. So, you know, football is a sport where one kick, a couple of kicks can completely change the way we talk about games, ties, people, everything. So let's not go overboard. But it was a very encouraging night and moment for Arsenal. I think we can say now that whatever happens this season, it's been a successful one for them personally, because they've, you know, jumped a hurdle that they hadn't done since 2010. They will be in the last knockings of the title race into April. That is pretty certain, however that pans out in three ways. And, you know, it's a year of progress. And I think last night's result did show that. But yeah, in response to your original question, so I've lumped in various themes there. Mm.
Which was about half an hour ago, but that's fine.
The atmosphere was very good, Max.
Yeah. No, it felt, and actually, there is talk, isn't, you know, that the Emirates has had a bit of a bashing, but it feels like it is building now to be a bit of a cauldron. As a neutral, Nicky, I loved the tension. as an Arsenal fan, how was that?
Yeah, less fun. Less fun towards the end. Although,
I can imagine.
In the end, very satisfying. And talking about sort of even penalty shootouts, there was something in the Martin Odegaard reaction to that, the scoring of the first penalty and the sort of grabbing David Raya and giving him a shake and basically the sort of we're still up for this mindset rather than the sort of fearful thing you see teams go into penalty shootouts with. And I know that's sort of easy to put on everything with hindsight, right? But I always think about, you know, easy example is Italy-Spain in the Euros where Giorgio Chiellini is giving out bear hugs beforehand. There is a certain sort of way you can carry yourself going into a penalty shootout that is different, that I think transmits something. And I think it was something that helped a little bit in this shootout, was seeing the first penalty taken so confidently and then the response to that. I thought it was interesting as well. I wasn't unfortunately there. I was multi-screening with the Napoli game, but Nick can probably speak to this more than I can. It sounded loud in that shootout as well. Every time a Porto player was going up, it sounded like it was a really like crowd are going to get on top and try to make it harder for them as well. So I thought that was interesting to observe. But no, it was an incredibly tense night. I do think inevitably we are an English language podcast with a massively English language audience. But I think that the thing about Arsenal not looking impressive, Porto are very good at making you not look impressive. Porto did a very similar job unsuccessfully against Inter last season at this stage. Sergio Conceição is a good coach. And I think that one of the things that struck me in both of these ties, I know everyone's going to zoom in on the acts of play acting or whatever, things that got their goat. But I think they managed to make time pass, wasted time, without just that. Like, while the ball is in play, you would have 10 minutes disappear and you'd think, what happened in those 10 minutes? Nothing. And that's a testament to what Porto are doing, keeping Arsenal at arm's length and just not letting them have those opportunities.
Yeah. And actually, you're right, aren't you, Johnny? I wondered, Arsenal felt flat a bit in this game, but that is because Porto were brilliant, I thought. And they played more than I was expecting them to. And in Pepe, they have this guy who is 41. It's sort of mad.
They carried out, over the 210 minutes or whatever it was, they carried out their game plan almost perfectly. You know, there is basically one little slip. The right back basically doesn't cover Trossard's run, and that's it. That's literally the only thing they do. They don't take their penalties, and that's it. They're out. And I guess that's the, when you were a club of sort of that level, those are the margins that kill you. But yeah, they were quite threatening on the counter. Obviously, great in the first leg. Just really, really spatially, tactically disciplined. Like, hardly anybody was left one-on-one. There's always, you know, there was always a midfielder or there was a centre half coming into cover. And then obviously, yeah, you have Pepe, who's, yeah, 41, and you know, we're going to talk about like a 17-year-old centre back later for Barcelona, but this is, you know, a guy who's I don't know, he's so old that he basically finds the Emirates a bit loud. He feels a little bit, he is old enough to think that the Tifos and the Ultras are a bit much now. He kind of preferred it in the older days. I researched this during the World Cup, actually. Pepe made his debut in the same season that Mark Hughes retired. There was overlap in the careers of Mark Hughes and Pepe. And I find that incredible. And yeah, I think Conceição is a great man. Yeah, just based on these, you know, what he's done in the Champions League this season, I have a lot of time for him. And I, you know, it's unfortunate for them, but they've come up against a better, well-resourced side. And I think they've come up against the atmosphere as well. I just want to make one point about penalties, right?
Yeah.
There is this kind of, I think there's a sort of false opposition between people say, oh, penalties is a lottery, it's all emotions and, you know, whatever. And people say, no, it's a repeatable skill, it's totally controllable. And I think it's actually neither. It is a repeatable skill, obviously, but it's actually a controllable emotional moment. And the way that Arsenal controlled, you know, the way that Nicky was talking about how they sort of got themselves up for it, and Porto have lost their last 7 penalty shootouts and now 8 in a row. I think that shows that it's one of those things that you can control, but it's not something that is just a repeatable skill. You have to harness the emotions and the psychology of it as well.
Mm. I think David Raya dived the same way for every penalty. So I think at some point, does that become like a double bluff? The next Porto player is thinking, well, he can't dive that way again, so I'll put it there. I mean, the first save was brilliant. Bit of fortune that it bounced off his legs and went out. Just on Pepe, when he was born, number one was Too Shy by Kajagoogoo, which is such a relief for me that it's so old. I'm not really sure if I know the song. Whereas I normally don't know the song because it's so recent. And we'll get to the Barcelona kids in a minute. I wonder, Nick, with Arsenal, they've been so good in the Premier League, right? In the last, what, they've won eight in a row. And okay, they weren't amazing against Brentford. But I just wonder if there is just a difference between knowing that if you don't deliver, you are out in this compared to you're playing the Premier League. Okay, their fixture list has been quite friendly in these incredible wins. And we've talked a lot about have they made these teams look bad or was it just a nice run of games? But they just didn't look the same, did they, in this game?
I still think that's about the opponent. I do think the other thing more generally about the opponent is not even specific to Porto. I think there's still somehow... And this shouldn't be for someone like Mikel Arteta. I'm sure that there isn't for lots of those players, but certainly in the way things are talked about in England, I think there's still some naivety about, oh, it's good in the Premier League means you can just go into Europe and be good. It's different football played in Europe. It is different leagues have different styles. And I think you can go back to one of the great teams that I grew up watching, not that I was a fan at the time, but Manchester United under Sir Alex Ferguson, how long it took him to get it right in Europe. It's not straightforward to go, oh, we're doing well, even in the richest and therefore inverted commas best league. It doesn't mean you get to just go and play teams from other countries and assume they're going to be inferior. It doesn't work like that. It's a different kind of football. And I do think there's adjustments to that that people don't always acknowledge. I think on the night, there was some individual performance you thought, yes, maybe not at the level we've seen recently. I didn't think it was Saka's best night, although he took his penalty well when he needed to. There was a viral thing that went round after Brighton against Roma because there were some English pundits talking about, and I'm afraid I don't know them. They're on Football Daily talking about if Brighton were in Serie A, they'd win the league. And everyone, of course, who follows Italian football was enjoying that because they got thumped by Roma, who are nowhere near winning the league in Serie A. And I think that this sort of idea of, oh, it's Porto, who, by the way, beat Benfica, what, 5-0 the other day? The idea that they should have been playing at the same level as Sheffield United, who you're thumping six past is ridiculous. And I think the goal Arsenal scored, by the way, which we haven't really talked about, was flipping brilliant. They had to score a
Odegaard
brilliant goal.
It was amazing. His feet, I think Barney wrote it up perfectly. His feet were insane, Odegaard's, in that moment.
Yeah, incredible pass. Like it was the only window it could go through. Trossard took the shot on perfect. I think that's actually an underrated finish by Trossard as well. I think when you look at it, I think that's not an easy finish at all. So you do have to be brilliant in the Champions League. You do have to play at those levels. And maybe not, again, not for a second suggesting that Mikel Arteta or his players are pundits sitting around saying, oh, Brighton would win Serie A. But I think that perhaps it's still an adjustment to play against the very best in Europe from some teams you get to play in the Premier League.
There was a good Josh wrote on that Odegaard assist, quoting Rio Ferdinand saying, you can't give a locksmith like that the keys. This is the whole point of a locksmith is they don't require the keys.
Well, you can't give him the keys, Max, or he'll just print several more copies and give them out to everyone.
That's a very good point.
I was just about to back up the point that, yeah, Porto do have some really good players. And I think it's quite easy to forget that when we're sort of talking about shithousing and dark arts and stuff like that, some of which was there. But I don't think Arsenal, by the way, were blameless on some of their fouls either, which I think is easily forgotten. I thought the other Pepe for Porto, the number 11, was
Pepe.
Is that how we do it?
Yeah, there's an accent on the E.
Okay.
On the second E.
So I was impressed with Pepe, but even more with Pepe, or at least equally with Pepe. I thought he was an excellent ball carrier. He sliced through that midfield two or three times, and the final ball was sometimes off. And the left back Wendell, I thought after Saka burned him up the first time in the game, absolutely had his number in a way that not many people have. So, yeah, you know, you can go through individuals and say, you know, these teams and Porto are a team that produce players time after time after time, who we'll probably end up seeing in the Premier League or La Liga quite soon or wherever. We can't write them off or disparage them.
Did you know that there are two Aldis?
There are two Aldis?
Yeah, there were two Aldis.
Is that Aldi and Aldi?
Well, yeah, exactly. It's like there's two Pepes on the pitch, right? There's two Aldis, Aldi Nord and Aldi Süd. There's two brothers, and they had a massive falling out about a couple of decades ago. So, and
are we talking about the supermarket?
Yeah, the supermarket, and they divided up.
Okay, all right.
They divide.
I wasn't sure what we were talking about.
They divided up the world between them. So in the UK we get Aldi Süd. That's it's the dark blue logo, and then there's an Aldi Nord, and other countries get the Aldi Nord. They just started divvying it up.
Do they sell different products?
They're basically different supermarkets, but they're both called Aldi, and they both have the same logo, but in slightly different colours. Anyway, that's just what the two Pepes made me think of.
Yeah, no, and you were right to bring it up. what do you think, Johnny, of Arsenal's chances then in the Champions? A lot of people saying, they're the one team that could give Man City a go over two legs, and I'm sure they could. But I wonder if, again, we're in that sort of Premier League hubris situation, right? You know, whoever they get now, they will come up almost certainly against another, if not gnarled, like experienced Champions League team.
Yeah, I mean, you said it was 14 years since they'd made the quarterfinal. I'd say it's probably at 16 or 17 at least since they actually felt like they could win it. Since they were genuinely one of the best teams in Europe. I mean, 14 years ago they came up against that Barcelona side. You know, it was the Messi night when he scored four. And you know, I think even though they made that stage, you wouldn't say that they were among the European elite, and they are now. But It's one of those where, you know, you feel like they could beat City in the same way that Spurs turned over City in 2019, but could very easily lose to an Inter, say, or a Borussia Dortmund. It's one of those because of, you know, what Nicky was saying about that inexperience of this level of European football. We're talking about a performance at home against Porto in front of an incredibly loud and passionate crowd. But in order to win this competition, you need to, you know, you can't just blow teams away in the first 15 minutes at home. You need to go into hostile environments and atmospheres that are against you and put in big away performances. And that's, I think, what we haven't yet seen. They did pretty well in Seville. I wasn't in Seville, but I mean, I can't speak to the atmosphere there, but they need to go into an elite theatre. Basically, they need to do what United did in Turin in 99. Do they have a performance like that in them? We don't know. We don't know that yet.
Conceição claimed that Arteta insulted his family after the final whistle. What Arteta said towards the bench in Spanish, he insulted my family, he said in the news conference. Arsenal club sources have said that Arteta denies the accusations. No comment, thank you very much, is what Arteta says. I think John Cross from the Mirror is saying Conceição has a bit of form for saying after games, he insulted my family. It's a kind of go-to, you know, he said your mum 100 times, which, you know, if Arteta did that, in many ways, sort of begrudging respect to yell your mum at another grown man. You were nodding, Nick. You've seen that sort of history before.
Yeah, I think just from the very, it was very late at night by this point, but a few of us were looking this stuff up after the game. And I think there's some previous with Tuchel and with Guardiola as well. There's been a sort of simmering dislike between these two managers, even around the first leg, actually, where Arteta expressed his distaste for how Porto had gone about it. And Conceição was saying, oh yeah, they just came here to play nice football, blah, blah, blah. And you sort of got the feeling from the start that they didn't like each other that much. So I guess Arteta may well have had some feedback from Pep, shall we say, on Conceição's modus operandi. But yeah, it was, I mean, I think from what we know, I think it was Conceição trying to deflect slightly, which goes back to my point, though, from earlier, that a couple of penalties different, and we're talking about him being a hero and masterclass, and which big job is he off to next, and that kind of thing. But instead, we're in the realm of your mum slurs.
We are. Well, you know, we're only going to get sillier, but lots of people talking about Leandro Trossard looking quite a lot like Clement Turpin. David said, should pressure be put on UEFA to investigate the fact that Leandro Trossard was both playing in and refereeing the last 16 tie? It's a great photo of the two of them just looking at each other. And it is quite striking how much they look alike. TH90 said, did Declan Rice have his own Munich moment? Yes, there is a video doing the rounds of Declan Rice bending over. I mean, I haven't looked at it too many times, Johnny. It could be a grass stain. He could have shat himself. They are the two possibilities, I guess.
Yes. I mean, do you want me to analyse this? Or, you know, should we get the electric pen out and start drawing, you know, circles and arrows on it like they do on Monday Night Football? Yes. I mean, I guess the two possibilities here are Declan Rice shat himself and Declan Rice did not shat himself. And without, you know, without knowing, it's hard to say which it was.
Sure. Well, lots of people did ask us, so we did have to reference it. I think you answered it absolutely perfectly, and that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll begin with Barcelona's win over Napoli. Hi, Pod fans. Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May the 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. So Barca 3, Napoli 1, Barca 3, 4-2 on aggregate. Like I said in the intro, Nicky, it makes it look quite straightforward. And Barca might have been the better side and they raced into that lead. But Napoli really pushed them into this game. And this was pretty feisty as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, it's classic multi-screen chat here because I had the big screen on the Barcelona game to start the night. And then Barcelona went 2-0 up and you thought, all right, time to put Arsenal on the big screen. Then immediately Napoli scored back. So there was a lot of back and forth on...
I've got to say, that's very professional of you, Nicky. I know, Serie A is, that's your heartland, that's your bread and butter. But when your team, I would have forgiven you for putting Arsenal on the big TV.
We started with Napoli on the big screen. Having just sort of given the big talk about underestimating European teams, I did come away from this game thinking, God, Barcelona... Yes, they're brilliant going forward, but they're awful at the back. They are really, really bad at the back. So it was a wide open game. I mean, the first goal that Barcelona scored, Fermín López, was like Napoli's defending was like something out of one of those slapstick silent movies where you've got like defenders going woo, running with their legs up, flailing one direction, but certainly nowhere near the football. And it felt ridiculously easy. 2 minutes later, Cancelo makes it 2-0, and you just thought, well, this should be done, but it wasn't because actually, every time Napoli did go forward, it seemed like Barcelona were there for the taking. They were playing really high and tight on Victor Osimhen, which I think could and probably should have been a recipe for disaster. Napoli were not getting the final ball right most of the time, and there's a whole conversation to have with Napoli about self-inflicted harms, which frankly I could do a whole show on because it goes back to everything that happened with Luciano Spalletti and Aurelio De Laurentiis, the owner, and the fact that that relationship broke down, the fact that you had your first title win in 33 years and you managed to sabotage it and get to the point where this season you've gone through three different managers already. But among the self-inflicted harms that felt particularly poignant on this night, Piotr Zielinski, who is one of the best passers on this team, is not in the Champions League squad because his contract's running down and he wouldn't sign a new one. So they just decided not to put him in the squad for the knockouts, even though he's been really effective in the league. This is, of course, before the last managerial change. I think throughout this game, I just sat there thinking if you had Zielinski on the pitch to play some through balls for Osimhen, you'd probably have had a heap of goals. But Barcelona were brilliant at times going forward. I mean, Yamin Lamal is something else, absolutely ridiculous 16-year-old talent. Robert Lewandowski is Robert Lewandowski, and I think they can score goals against anyone. I think they were definitely the better team here, although I do think that at 2-1, Napoli should have had a penalty for Kubasi's step on Osimhen's toe. I felt like the commentary in England at least was very uncharitable to Osimhen, saying, oh, he's making a fuss. Well, he was making a fuss because he had his toe trod on in the penalty area, and it would have been a penalty. There was also a header for Lindstrom at 2-1, which...
Massive chance. It's just before Lewandowski scores, right, isn't it?
So there was real chances for Napoli, but I do think Barcelona, in this game and across both legs, were the better team and deserved to go through.
Yeah, and Christensen maybe could have got sent off as well. That was quite a pivotal moment. This for Barcelona is, because Barcelona, Johnny, are in such a financial mess, getting through this, which I think gets you, I don't know, 10 million euros or something, is actually really significant, which sort of sounds ridiculous given how much money swirls about the game.
Yeah, I mean, the story's coming out of Spain this morning that Barcelona have already leveraged their quarterfinal place. They're selling it off to a private investor, and Silver Lake are going to purchase a 30% stake in their quarterfinal, which is definitely going to ease their some of their shorter term.
Like a charity game, like a large man will come on who just, you know, just play 30 minutes in the second half, and they'll just let him have a shot.
It's all on paper. It's all on paper these days, Max. It's all kind of locked away in a filing cabinet. You know, that's how it works these days. Yeah, I mean, in terms of how, like, the rest of this season, you know, obviously Xavi has said he's leaving, and it's too late for them to obviously save, you know, the La Liga title. But there is a kind of liberation to him. It's almost like there's a huge weight off his shoulders. I think you can kind of see that in the way Barcelona are playing, and what his job at now is kind of leaving a legacy. You know, you see the likes of, you know, Pau Cabarsí in defence, who's, you know, 17, making his debut in a Champions League quarterfinal from the start in the centre of defence. You know, guys like Yamal and you know, the Sergio Roberto, the youngest 32-year-old La Masia graduate in the squad. he's obviously, you know, they've been partly forced into it by finances, but this is Xavi, I think, trying to leave something that the next guy can build on. And, you know, I don't think they are solid enough defensively to win the title. But I do think they can go on a run in it, because of the freedom and, you know, the options and the tools they have going forward, they can cause a lot of teams a lot of damage. Maybe like a few months ago, you wouldn't mind drawing Barcelona because they were a bit of a shambles. But I think the way things are just sort of coming together for them now, I think a lot of teams would be thinking, I'm not sure I want them anymore.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, when you get to this stage, most teams, you go, oh, they are at least quite good at something. I guess the fact, Nick, that Barcelona are not playing at the Nou Camp is quite big. We talked about how big the Emirates has been for them, for Arsenal. Like, not having the Nou Camp is a big deal, I think, for Barca.
Yeah, I've never actually been to, been outside the Montjuïc Stadium, but never been to a game there. But it always seems a bit more distant, doesn't it? The crowd seems further back, maybe, and just a little bit more sort of echoey. And I guess, yeah, it's a big psychological realignment, I guess, for especially players who know it, who know the Nou Camp well and know the atmosphere well, to sort of recalibrate and treat it as their home and build up the same kind of atmosphere and mystique, if you like, that the Nou Camp has. So, yeah, fair play to them for harnessing whatever there is in Montjuic and putting in what looked, from what I saw, like a really intense performance last night. Whether better opponents than Napoli or more practiced ones can sort of turn that on its head and pick them off, remains to be seen. But yeah, they're making a pretty good fist of it. And I'd quite like to visit Montjuic for a match while they're playing there, to be honest.
I don't actually know if this is crazy, because for a game like this, Camp Nou would always be sold out. I don't know if they even sold out Montjuic for this one. I know it was,
yeah, they couldn't fill the ground. They couldn't fill it.
It has been really, really unpopular. Just to drag back to boring money conversations, Max, because you mentioned about the prize money for going through. For Napoli in this game, if they won, it was going to mean moving ahead of Juventus in the spots for the Club World Cup next year. So,
oh, right.
Aurelio De Laurentiis was offering some pretty huge bonuses to the players. They didn't make it, so Juventus get that spot. And that's worth 50 million euros, apparently, being in the Club World Cup next year. So Juventus, the big winners from Napoli going out.
Nick Stoll, colleague of mine at Stan, who's out in Spain, said it's 250 euros for a ticket, when the average salary in Barcelona is around 700, you know, euros a week. Tourists used to come and pay whatever to see Messi and the rest, and they don't do that now. They gave members an option of not renewing the season ticket this season, but still getting to keep their seats at the Camp Nou. So I think a lot of people just stopped having a gap year. Interestingly, also the stadium is up a big hill, which Andy Brassel said to me was, you know, that's a bit of a hike, isn't it? The band The Weeknd filled it last summer, and their support acts were Kay Trinada and Mike Dean. And I'm very excited to hear that Mike Dean was supporting The Weeknd. The Weeknd is one man, apparently. There we go. You
know, The Weeknd is a person.
It's a person. There we go. Keep it in. I don't care. You know, if it was Top Loader, that's a band. Heard of them. If it was Cast, you know, I understand it. Anyway, good luck to the weekend in everything, in all his endeavors. I sound like Pepe. What's his infernal racket? The point I was trying to make is that Mike Dean was supporting the weekend, but, you know, sadly, I looked it up. It's a 59-year-old DJ from San Francisco or something. It's not actually Mike Dean. Jim says, how mad would it have been if UEFA had turned the Champions League into Choose Your Own Adventure? This is Miguel Delaney writing The Independent. The newly expanded Champions League, so they're trying to work out how to do the draw. It's going to have like a tennis-style seeding system for the knockout stages. They did have an idea where if you come top of that league, right, so the top eight go through and then the next 16 go into a knockout. If you come in the top eight, if you come first, you get first pick of who to play. You'd pick your opponent, which, like, I mean, it's simultaneously terrible, but utterly amazing.
Oh, I sort of love it. It's horrendous.
Yeah.
But imagine exactly the team that gets picked, how they're going to come into that game with that mindset. I mean, there's the potential for soap opera drama is brilliant.
It's the draw equivalent of sort of putting up on the dressing room wall someone completely slagging you off for motivation, yeah. Isn't it? Like, if you're the underdog.
This is basically what happened. They tried it in Super League, in Rugby League, where the playoff... It. The team at the top of the table got to choose their opponents for the knockout rounds, and I think after a while, the bigger clubs, the successful clubs, are like, can you stop doing this? Because it's just firing them up, and the fifth place club or whatever would come out fired up. It's basically like, you know, that bit in a reality show where, you know, you have to make your nominations publicly, you have to publicly evict someone, and they go, I'm so sorry, yeah. I'm so sorry, you know, I just had to choose someone, and I'm choosing you, and
yeah,
you know, I think it's fun, but I think it injects a little bit more of this kind of fake, artificial sort of reality TV nonsense into sport, and I'm not in favour, but you know, it drives content, so it probably will happen at some point.
Yeah, no, yeah, I agree with you. I think it's absolutely terrible, but at the same time, you know, the idea of going Arsenal and Mikel Arteta says I'm picking Porto because Conceição's mum's an idiot, you know, then you're suddenly like, okay, now this is exciting. Yeah, I can't help the sort of bloodlust in me going, yeah. Or you're like a reality show where they go, PSV, I think you're a wonderful, you've been a great housemate. I really enjoyed you in the league stages. I have to pick someone, so I've gone with you, PSV. I'm sorry. Anyway, that isn't going to happen. They also modelled that if they did the draw manually, it would take 4 hours, which seems to be actually less time than it takes now. But anyway, it's going to be done. It's going to be done automatically. Back to Italy. Reports overnight that Maurizio Sarri has resigned at Lazio. Is that a surprise? Not a surprise?
Not a huge surprise. I think perhaps timing is obviously interesting because there's a bunch of the season left. Having said that, Lazio have been losing a lot of games. They're no longer in a very well positioned for the European hunt. His relationship with Claudio Lotito, the owner, has clearly been deteriorating for a while. Ever since the transfer window, he's been pretty open in saying that he wasn't happy with decisions that were made, that he hasn't been given. And the players that he wanted. I think the Champions League was the one thing that he was still enjoying. And you know, with Maurizio Sarri, he doesn't hide his emotions, does he? Right? He wears them on his sleeve. He lets you know exactly what he's thinking. And he often is thinking along quite grumpy lines. But he's been very clear that he wasn't having an enjoyable time. I think the two games against Bayern Munich clearly got him motivated and enjoyed them, but I think it was certainly, I was expecting that their relationship wasn't going to last past the end of this season. The fact that he's made the choice to walk now, I wonder if it's almost giving himself room to decide if this is going to be an until the end of the season break or a longer break. It's if you take the break now, then you can give yourself a couple of months to decide if you want another job next season or if you're looking at a sabbatical.
All right, that'll do for part two. Part three will begin with Monday Night Football, Chelsea's 3-2 win over Newcastle. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So Chelsea beat Newcastle 3-2 in the race for 10th place, or probably the Conference League, maybe the Europa League. Cole Palmer again, very impressive. Johnny. I think that he's probably the story of this game.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the story is been quite a familiar one for Chelsea this season, like incredible moments of speed and promise, and you know, Cole Palmer playing well, and Nicholas Jackson, you know, running through people and occasionally himself, and then just moments when they play like absolute children, and this is Chelsea should not have been anywhere close to losing this game, and yet somehow it feels like they sneaked by. When in fact, you know, they were, I think, in control for large periods. And it's hard trying to find new things to say about Chelsea because they're just such a thoroughly immature team. And Palmer is obviously, he's the guy who makes it work. Gallagher, I think, had a good first half, not so good second half. And, you know, they're still a work in progress. They are the most expensive, football's most expensive work in progress.
I was going to praise Mykhailo Mudryk.
Please do.
Because he's kind of been, I guess, almost the epitome of what's been happening at Chelsea, the sort of brashness of the whole thing. He was nailed on to be the signing that a rival Arsenal really, really wanted. And then they sort of helicoptered in at the last minute, took him out, bought him, possibly against his will, maybe. And it all started quite badly for him, not so well, as a lot of pressure on him with a price tag, of course. But I mean, I haven't seen him week in, week out, but is he coming good? You're more than happy to respond and say, nah. But I thought his finish was good, actually. Very important time in the game. You know, you get that goal, you wrap it up.
I'd say he still had, inverted commas, work to do, didn't he?
Well, yeah. He did. But he got around the keeper and slotted it in, didn't he? He had work to do. Quick, nimble feet and a finish. And he's got, I think, two in his last three. He's got five or six goals this season. And definitely a player who, if you can unlock, will do something for you. Like half of this Chelsea team. But I just wonder if sort of him coming good would be a symbol of Chelsea and this Chelsea era kind of blundering through and finding its feet at last. I don't know. I just thought he's in quite good form, relatively speaking. So I thought I'd interject.
That's exactly what we're all here for. You know, greatly appreciated. I said, interesting for these sides, Nicky, is like, do you want, and it's a conversation that happens every year, right? You want to end the season strongly because it makes you feel good about going to next season. Do you want to qualify for Europe because, you know, is a possible trophy? You'd imagine Newcastle could give the Europa League a really good run, Chelsea as well, even though Chelsea have, you know, won the Champions League before, so you feel a bit like, oh, can we be bothered? Or do you want to have those spare weeks that like Tottenham have this season, which we now sort of feel like might actually help them when they're going against Villa, who've got European football for next year?
Yeah, I think certainly looking at Tottenham, it's hard to shake off that sense at the moment, the freshness that you get from not playing in those competitions. But having said that, Chelsea have, I think, the youngest average starting 11 of the whole Premier League. And I think that those players will want to get into Europe to play European competitions. I think they should have, not only do they have a young squad, they have a huge squad, Chelsea, of course. And I think those players should want to get into European competition and have more opportunities to play, more opportunities to develop. So I think certainly for Chelsea, that seems like an easy answer. And I think for Newcastle as well, again, I know they were in the Champions League this season and they got that brilliant or awful group, depending on how you want to view it. But certainly six big games against Borussia Dortmund, Milan and Paris Saint-Germain. I think that having had that taste of it, to not be in Europe with everything that they've spent and with how lavish that project is, would seem disappointing, I would have thought. So I think they should both be very much motivated still to get into Europe.
I'd like to praise another footballer, if that's all right. I would like to praise Isak, whose finish was, I thought, lovely. And he's just got this effortless way of like gliding with the ball and with barely any backlift, just stroking it and making it look easy when it's really, really not. I just thought that was a lovely finish. And I think, obviously, he's had his ins and outs and injury problems. But when he's in full flight, there's not another striker that I quite enjoy watching as much, I think, in the league, because you sort of feel he's capable of anything. And I just thought that was a very nice goal that kind of epitomised the way he operates.
I like Jacob Murphy's goal just because he kicked it so hard and Adam Sandler was there for some reason. Rumours that Todd Boehly is hoping to move on 15 players this summer. And you sort of think, Johnny, Chelsea can't be as mad this summer as they were last summer. But like, I don't even know how they'd even begin to get rid of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the best, obviously the best way, you know, the way that a genius like Todd Boehly would try and shift 15 players this summer is to tell everybody, tell the whole of Europe through kind of well-placed sort of media stories that you're trying to move on 15 players. And you know, that's really going to, you know, to fuck the market up, basically. They're not going to be prepared for this. I think this is just we talk about the, you know, the financial gymnastics that they're going through, and obviously last week the financial results come out and the losses are bigger than usual, which probably means bigger than expected savings that need to be made to comply with FFP or PSR or you know, whatever you want to call it. But I think, you know, what we don't really talk about so much is almost the kind of the human side of it. These are young guys who have been, for the most part, this squad is full of young, you know, really talented young players who have been uprooted from whatever life or whatever milieu they were in, moved to London, you know, staying in a hotel or some flat that's basically where everything's still in cellophane and whatever. You don't know anybody. And now, you know, because of, you know, some bloke with a mullet and who decides to move you on, you now have to go somewhere else because some guy with a, you know, with a ballpoint pen has put a line through your name. There are lots of things to object to with this Chelsea project, but I think that the way it just kind of it treats like human talent as asset is I think the most offensive part of it for me. You just want to see some of these players on the pitch playing, getting support, getting, you know, getting settled. You know, learning, you know, or in many cases, relearning the joy of football. And it just doesn't happen at Chelsea, partly because of the atmosphere and the currents around the club, but partly because they are just treated like meat. And this is something that the club has been doing for decades now, buying up players like their houses, like, you know, investors, you know, buying up London property and flipping them, or selling them on, or sending them out on loan. And I just think it really stinks, to be honest, because, you know, how much wasted talent, how much inefficiency is there, so some guys can make the accounts look nice.
And actually, it's an interesting point you make. And we were looking at that Dejan Kulusevski Players Tribune article he did and the video he did, and like the first thing I read was him saying, you know, that Chelsea game, actually we may have lost, but we won at life. And I wanted to end with, but we also lost 4-1 to Chelsea. But actually, like the film is really interesting, and what he wrote is interesting, and it does make you think about these players. You know, he obviously, they're all so talented, and they're at the absolute top. And then he went to Juventus, and for the first time, people were sort of saying, actually, you're no good, you're hopeless, and you know, you're in and out of the team, and like. The sort of fortitude to get through that. And obviously all these elite people will reach their ceiling at some point unless they're messy, right? Like you have a ceiling, you are, you know, every time you move up, it's harder. But when you talk about those Chelsea players and sort of the fact that, you know, what Kulusevski is saying, he's now at a place where, you know, he loves the manager, everyone loves everyone, it's all great. It probably, that's what you have to say, right? But it felt real. And I suppose there are probably lots of Chelsea players, like you say, just sort of kicking about sad hotel rooms, being really young and not really knowing what the right thing to do is. And that's quite...
Well, you might not know the language, you know, you are incredibly rich. And
you'll get no sympathy because you're loaded.
But now right? You're surrounded by people who, you don't know where you can trust them. You don't know whether, you know, that they're just trying to get a cut of your income or whatever. You know, it's... And you are... 19 years old and still trying to work out who you are. It's brutal.
The Premier League's failed to secure an agreement for new financial settlement for English football. This is from The Guardian's reporting. The proposed deal would have passed down more than £900 million down the pyramid, also imposed a new set of financial cost controls on the top flight. At least 10 clubs are understood to have been in favour of making the offer, but not enough to clear the Premier League's rule that 14%. The league was criticised by the chair of the Cross-Party Culture and Media Sport Committee, Caroline Dynage, who said that the stated commitment from the Premier League clubs to striking a deal with the rest of the pyramid looks like nothing more than an empty promise. The Charlton minority owner, Charlie Methven, you may remember him in his red trousers from Sunderland Till I Die, accused two clubs of holding up the process, alleging West Ham and Crystal Palace were against a deal. There are a few Premier League clubs that are holding the industry back, are driving the rest of the industry mad for only thinking of their own short-term narrow self-interest, he told TalkSport. It's on record that Palace and West Ham are leaders of this King Canute-style movement. They need to grow up. Guardian understands that Vice Chair of West Ham, Karen Brady, has received an apology from Charlie Methven for those remarks. West Ham and Palace have been approached for comment. Paul says, interesting to hear Nick's view on his recent trip to Belgrade. I went in 2019 to see United play Partizan. Loved the city. Enjoyed his recent article. What were you doing there, Nick?
Yeah, I went to the Belgrade Derby, which I know feels like the sort of title of a Groundhopper blog from 10 years ago, but I did. I was in the region doing a few bits and pieces, some of which will be out nearer to the European Championship. Tied it in with this Belgrade versus Partizan, which I think we all know, we've probably all seen and read a lot about the atmosphere and the fans and the chanting and the flares and the fact that normally it's actually an absolutely terrible football match. This time, not too much went on in the stadium, but it was quite an intense and interesting football match. 2-2 draw, woodwork hit four times, stuff like that. So very, very enjoyable. I mean, the interesting thing about Serbia in general, this is, might be a longer conversation for another day, but for now, it's a very important country in Europe at the moment because it's sort of triangulating between the European Union and Russia and looking in two different directions as it's being pulled by Putin one way, possibly joining the EU another way. Then public sentiment is drawing very much away from the European Union and very pro-Russian. And then there's lots of issues around Kosovo as well and nationalist sentiment stirred up towards the situation there. And a lot of this stuff, anyway, manifests itself inside football stadiums more than anywhere else. So you see a lot of banners inside grounds asking Serbia to invade Kosovo again, basically, and lots of banners like that in the city of Belgrade as well, which is, you know, feeling like quite a tense and uncomfortable place at the moment. The government is very these days authoritarian. The recent election result that gave President Vucic another term has been is being contested. There's a lot of uncertainty and tension there. So I was broadly going to look at football as the kind of space and vector where a lot of these things are played out, and yeah, very, very interesting. A lot of the banners and flags and things like that that you see displayed inside the ground, and yeah, I'll write more on that later. I wrote a little piece about it, I think, a day or two ago, but yeah, Serbia is quite an interesting and troubling place at the moment in Europe, and obviously they're playing England too in the European Championship in June. I mean, the national team is always mercurial, isn't it? I think is the word to describe it. They're sort of very, very talented, but quite flaky. But no, interesting trip. Always a cracking stadium, the Maracanã that Red Star play at. But there's so much non-football trouble and tension going on there at the moment. And I think the direction that Serbia eventually turns in politically, because it's going to have to at some point, is going to be quite important for the future of the continent, really. And this all gets played out through football.
Johnny says, how good are Lincoln City? Jim says, Lincoln are good, aren't they, Max? Rich says, can we play Cambridge every week? Craig says, what is a Cambridge United and is it biodegradable? This is after Lincoln City beat Cambridge 6-0. It is looking quite the Gary Monk. I don't know what the opposite of a new manager bounce is. I said new manager thud or new manager splat. But yeah, it was a very... It felt that Lincoln had about five more players than us. And I don't think they did, but it's looking pretty bleak. And we have a little 4-point cushion above the relegation zone at the bottom of League One. And I don't think that'll last for long. Andrew notes that Dobbin the Mule was the pantomime horse from Rent-A-Ghost, the kids' TV show from the 80s. Right, so I was correct about it. On the subject of fridge audits, because someone asked if we had anything in our fridge we'd got longer ago than when Valerian Ishmael was appointed at Watford. But it was actually quite a long time. It was like 92 days or something. Tim says, I have a kiwi fruit in my fridge that I bought when I first moved out of my parents' house in 2006. I call it Cecil. I don't recall why. It's completely devoid of moisture, solid as a rock, and has been joined by a lemon and a banana. I took it on holiday without my partner knowing. The banana, you can't...
Banana in the fridge.
Keep banana. But like, I mean, you can't have had a banana since, you know, the mid-2000s. Alex says, regarding the age of items in our fridges, I decided to do an audit, and I can confirm that our fridge contained the following items that were definitely older than 304 days. It was 304 days, apparently, for Ishmael. Miso, sliced jalapenos, fish sauce, oyster sauce, horseradish, bulldog sauce, Thai red curry paste, chocolate sauce for ice cream, marmalade, chili oil, maple cream, sweet relish, cherries, Hondashi salted shrimp, pickled cucumber. I'd also like it on record that my wife caught me mid-audit and asked, "What the hell are you doing?" To which I responded, "Trying to answer a question for a football podcast I like. I fear I may soon be relegated to Barry's park bench." And finally, Rob Priestley Fenn writes a lovely email saying, "Dear Max, Barry and all, first time contact via email. I've been loving your dulcet tones ever since you made a guest appearance on the Cheese Room podcast," which is a Tottenham podcast I went on. "You've all provided me with a lot of laughs as well as comfort in hard times. This last year saw my dad plunge, and it really was remarkably quick through the depths of Alzheimer's until he passed in April. The pods always helped me take my mind off things and provide some much needed light relief. I've always wanted to contribute, but I've never felt like I had the material that would really add value until now. It did make me laugh when Baz mentioned cranberry sauce as a long-term inmate of the fridge. I just knew that this time I could contribute, so behold, it must easily be from 2015-16, considering the best before is 2017. Why do people like this stuff? Why do we even buy it? Keep up the good work. Thank you to the team for various incredibly moving pods over the last few years. And from Barry's moving at the same time, jovial stint in the Moon Underwater pod, which was very good. And Nikki's fascinating backstory, along with all the other incredible investigative specials you cover so well. Cheers, Rob. Thank you. That's enough compliments for one pod, isn't it? And that'll do for today. Thank you, Nick.
Thank you.
Thanks, Nikki.
Thanks.
Thanks, Johnny.
Thanks.
Football Weekly is produced by Joel Grove. Our executive producer is Daniel Stevens. We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.